Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The steal by Iverson! Posting in! He won! Wow. He won the game!
Being there to say absolutely no!
Three from Scott! Yes! Do you love this game?
Another exciting edition of the Sixers Talk Podcast. Danny Pommels, Paul Hudrick here with you. Thank you for subscribing at NBCSportsPhiladelphia.com. Wherever you get your podcasts, keep those five-star ratings coming. Those thoughts, those questions, those suggestions, comments, we always appreciate it. We are here joined by, I'm just going to say it, this is my favorite guest that we've ever had on the pod. I'm going to enjoy jogging his memory about some of the things that he has enjoyed over his illustrious basketball career. But without further ado, it is Jim Lynham, the coach, joining us here on the pod. Coach, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, guys. Good to have a chance to share some thoughts in these tough times.
Yeah, everyone's feeling that same way, Coach. Me and Paul have been hammering away at the podcast these past few weeks, trying to squeeze the juice out of the basketball and get all the thoughts of all our colleagues and everyone out there in the community, the Sixers community, who's trying to make it through this ordeal as we deal with this pandemic. But Coach, we got to deal with the hot button issue of the moment. Sixers Talk brought to you by Wilmington University. As always, Wilmu works. And suddenly we have a little this topic that emerged because of a local Delaware Valley guy. Leon Rose out of Cherry Hill pops up with this new position with the New York Knicks. He's no longer Joel Embiid's agent. And he decides through a source to put some feelers out for Elton Brand for all intents and purposes. If the Sixers weren't going to retain him, according to the source, next season, he would want to hire him in a Knicks front office position. It had to catch you off guard, Coach, because it caught me off guard, caught Paul off guard. You can check out Paul's article on this story on NBCSportsPhiladelphia.com. But what was your first impression when you heard about Elton Brand's name being bounced around?
Well, I guess like everyone else that you just mentioned, Danny, I was caught somewhat off guard. I really would be unaware of, if there's a personal relationship between Leon Rose and Elton. You know, obviously professional, those types speak all the time, meaning a general manager of a team with a high-level agent, so that there'd be some familiarity, no surprise there. But as you say, Leon, with his new position with the Knicks, he's going to be on the hunt for what he deems talent, be it talent in the front office or talent on the basketball court. And I think, Elton has garnered a lot of attention in these recent times with his work with the Sixers. And I think rightly so. And I really got to know Elton as a player when he signed as a free agent with the Sixers. I was still coaching. You know, I'm a big fan of Elton the person. You know, you can't get a better guy than Elton Brand. He was a very diligent, hardworking, like professional as a player. And my sense is that he's taken all those qualities and, you know, applied them to his position in the front office.
Paul, obviously a few odd things about this story. First and foremost, the Knicks already have a GM. Scott Perry is still in the position. So, and obviously this hasn't come out of Leon Rose's mouth. It's really through a source are these feelers. But Paul, give us an idea of how you felt about this, because I know it had to catch you off guard. And number two, it just really speaks to Elton Brand's, I guess, what he's built as a reputation here, coming from you know, coaching the G League team, or excuse me, from being the GM of the G League team, and now here he is calling the shots with the 76ers.
Yeah, I was definitely surprised. The first thing I did, you know, it was Stefan Bondi from the New York Daily News who first had the report out. And my first thought was, I thought back to earlier in the season, I had the opportunity to have a one-on-one interview with Josh Harris, the team's managing partner. And the biggest takeaway I got from that is that he loved Elton Brand. Of all the things that we talked about, of all the things that we discussed, his eyes seemed to light up the most when we were discussing Elton. And, you know, they had a lot of really good candidates for the position before they hired Elton. You know, they interviewed Gerson Rosas, who was a Rockets guy who is now the GM of the Timberwolves. They interviewed, you know, people in the Golden State front office, people in the Utah Jazz front office. So they interviewed a lot of people with a lot of experience. Elton obviously didn't have that, but to what Coach was saying, you know, the sense you got of him as a player is that he was a pro, and just the way he handled himself, the way he went about his business. And then on top of that, the way he was able to communicate and relate to young players. You know, he unretired to come back and play for the Sixers during the process era. So, and a big part of that is, you know, because of the way he was able to relate to the younger guys. You know, so when this first broke out, I reached out, you know, to some people to try to find out, you know, what the Sixers thought was. You know, a team source told me that they're, you know, the quote, "We're very happy with the way that Elton Brand has performed since they hired him." The source said that in his leadership and strong working relationships with players, agents, and executives around the league, you know, they were very happy with all that. So I was certainly surprised to hear that. But I also know that in the report, Stefan Bondi wrote that, you know, the idea was if there was an opportunity, if the Sixers had gone through the playoffs and it hadn't worked out and they had decided to move on from Elton, that's when they would pursue him. But yeah, to me, I never saw a scenario in which I felt like Elton Brand, the organization, would move on from Elton, because I think they are really still very, you know, despite what's going on this season and the team underperforming, the Sixers are still very high on Elton Brand.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that makes it weird for me is the fact that what is that scenario where the Sixers move on from Elton Brand, considering that they had Brett Brown serving as the interim GM, went through an extensive search, settled on Elton, and gave him, you know, carte blanche on signing free agents and, you know, bringing in the guys he thought would make a difference in the organization. And then here we are, you know, he's trying to feel out whether or not the Sixers want to, you know, move on from him. Like, I don't see why that would even come to fruition. But, you know, I guess weirder things have happened. So, you know, you can't blame him for trying. I'm trying to figure out what the underlying, what he was trying to establish, maybe just putting pressure on the organization as a whole. I don't know if that's something that he felt like he had seen or experienced as Joel Embiid's agent, that he felt like there was a bit of a tenuous relationship there between Elton and the organization or what, but it's just a weird posturing, because I don't see the lane that he was trying to pursue there.
Yeah. I just think it's, you know, when teams underperform, people are going to be on the hot seat, whether it's
okay.
on the Good hot point. Seat or in the hot seat in the court of public opinion or what have you. So maybe there was just a perception in Leon Rose's, you know, mind. And it's, you know, it obviously the Sixers were pretty strong in their saying, "Hey, we're very happy with the job Elton's done. We are supporting Elton." So, you know, I don't think it's really about it's not about the Sixers to me. It's more about Leon Rose is looking for good people. Leon Rose is trying to bring the Knicks organization back up. And to a lot of the really good things we said about Elton Brand, Leon Rose sees those things and he wants to usher in a new era with the Knicks. And he wants a guy like that to run the show. So I can't say I blame Leon Rose for that. I know in the report, again, Stefan Bondi said that it was contingent on the Sixers not being happy with Elton Brand, but clearly they are.
Yeah, Danny, let me just add, I don't think that Leon Rose, let's say, floating a trial balloon to determine whether or not Elton Brand may be available, that doesn't in any way indicate Sixer interest or lack thereof of Elton and the job that he's been doing. I think, as Paul just said, this is a, you know, an initiative on Leon's part, and he's certainly welcome to do that.
Yeah, so both things don't have to be true at the same time. So I got you. One of the things, you know, speaking of Elton Brand, he helped bring Al Horford to this organization. Al Horford making a commitment to aid coronavirus pandemic sufferers in his home country of the Dominican Republic, as well as each U.S. region in which he's played basketball, the Michigan Gainesville area, Florida, the Michigan area, Gainesville, Florida area, Atlanta, Boston, and Philly. So kind of walking in the same footsteps as Joel Embiid, who pledged the same amount to help various people who are suffering within the Sixers organization, within the Philadelphia community. So just big pat on the back there to Al Horford for putting his money where his mouth is. But I think, Coach, when we're thinking about, you know, doing this podcast with you and the breadth of knowledge that you have with the game and forgotten more basketball probably than most of us will ever know, do you remember work stoppages like this in the NBA and how it affected the teams coming back? I mean, I know there have been several, you know, that you've been while you've been in your coaching ranks. But is there something that you feel like there's a precedent of restarting the season after this that you feel like will work for the NBA?
Well, you just grabbed the word that I've been using a form of, Danny. And the short answer to your question is no, because these times that we're in, if there's ever a poster child for a word, unprecedented, this is it. I mean, we've never experienced any of us like this ever in our lives. End of discussion. And as a result, as you try to apply, you know, previous situations to what we're going through now, and I don't care what facet of life you're speaking of, I think you limp when trying to grope for comparisons. So yes, I've been involved with strikes and work stoppages and shortened seasons and all the above. But as to how that relates to where we are right now, this is anyone's best guess. And I think the one thing of all the topics that I've, you know, watched on the TV, and I'm a big late night TV watcher usually, and obviously this quarantine situation has just accentuated that.
Sure.
But it's, you know, we're right now, we are at the mercy of this virus, plain and simple. So whether you're talking about, like, you know, can the play a regular season, is there any chance of salvaging it? And if so, or if not, what about playoffs, if not in a regular manner, in some contracted fashion? The answers to all those questions are pure speculation based on where we are with this virus and what the time frame will be to get it under some form of control.
I know I speak for Paul when, Coach, we say that we're just happy that you and your family are healthy and doing well and safe, particularly with you know, the fact that that Wednesday's game was played at the Wells Fargo Center against the Detroit Pistons, and the Wells Fargo Center has not been open since then. Christian Wood has since tested positive. People in the Sixers organization has tested positive. We obviously work in that arena, so, you know, glad to see that, you know, mostly everyone that we have known or come in contact with who works at the arena are healthy and doing well. So definitely happy about that. Coach, one thing me and Paul have come to agree on, whether the NBA starts up sooner or later, is that there has to be like a ramp up. Like, you can't just have this, you know, abrupt stoppage and then not have some type of, you know, I don't know if it's a 2-week training camp or, you know, some preseason game. I don't even know what to describe it as, but you can't just resume the regular season straight away. Would you agree with that?
I would, Danny. The problem is the calendar. And I think what you have to do is go forward and from that point try to go back. And by that I mean the start of next year. Let's just pick a date and say next season was due to open October 25th. I'm just picking a date.
Right.
So if you go backwards to where we are right now, the regular season has not yet been completed. And then you have playoffs. And then you have an NBA draft / free agency. And then you had what I call summer activity, you know, where the teams kind of get organized. They put young players and prospective prospects in a summer setting, and that helps the evaluation process. So obviously some portion, or maybe all portions, of what I just described have to be condensed, because we're not going to start tomorrow. We know that.
Right.
And we might not be starting whatever process is going to begin for maybe, what, let's say 6 weeks to 2 months. I think that's probably a fair time span from given where we think we are right now. So that some drastic changes are going to take place, there's no doubt about it. And if you want to speculate as to what those could be, I mean, it could be the kiss the 2019-2020 season goodbye. Meaning there's no way logistically to restart it in any way that makes sense to the average fan. I did this, and I'll be curious what you two guys think. Watching the TV, they do a lot now of best case scenario, worst case scenario, most likely scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say it this way. I'll propose. Well, we want to end. We have some kind of conclusion to the 2020 season. So I'll postulate the following. The best team in the East versus the best team in the West. The Milwaukee Bucks are going to play the Los Angeles Lakers. It won't be seven games. It'll be a five-game championship series. And we'll put it on national TV. Now, that would be like worst-case scenario to finish the 2020 season.
Obviously, they'll put that on TV.
No,
thank you. Yeah.
But the question is, would you guys buy that as any kind of a meaningful end to this season?
Nah, if you're telling me that, you know, a lockout shortened championship has an asterisk, that would probably have like 10 asterisks.
Okay, so that's yeah. You see the point. Yeah. So yeah. I think the number of people that I threw a kind of an absurd proposal, and that's what I would categorize it as, felt the same way you just did. All right, so then you have to try to start expanding that. All right, well, do you get two teams from the East and two from the West? Four teams from the – because I got news for you. You're not going to have a normal playoff. No, it's that goodbye. Impossible. You can't do it. The logistics will be absolute. This virus, Danny, it's not going to like end today and therefore jump on planes tomorrow and NBA players start flying around the country to visit different arenas. That's not how it's going to work. I think we all know that. So therefore, if in fact you even dream of ending this season, it has to be in some kind of a really truncated fashion. And I think you don't need a great imagination to start suggesting all of the problems that come along with that.
Right. And I know, Coach, too, there was the idea floated about by a bunch of people of just playing the playoffs in Las Vegas, just having all the teams there and basically playing in a bubble.
Or Atlantic City or wherever. Right. Yeah.
Well, the Vegas seems to be the strongest because they already host summer league games and there's already kind of infrastructure there to kind of make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Coach, do you see that as being, cause you know, like you just mentioned, logistically, you can't have these guys flying around all these different cities and all that. Could you see that being a solution where, you know, in a couple months, maybe we look at a city like Las Vegas where these guys can just stay and just play the games there and have it with no fans and just playing in that environment?
Yeah, Paul, I think I could say yes. And brighter minds than me are running these kinds of thoughts by each other, I can guarantee you, on a daily basis, if not physically at the league office, you know, on conference calls among those people. But as you start saying, well, what if, like trying to address the problems, does that mean you bring, or let's say in a normal setting, 8 teams from the East, 8 teams from the West, flying 16 teams and all the personnel associated with those teams into Vegas. And you're right. The infrastructure in Vegas could certainly accommodate that. And what they have in the way of playing facilities, I would say, yeah, that's probably possible also. But I think you're starting to get to a point where the time constraints really become huge. You're probably into June, certainly late May, early June at best, to get something like this off the ground. So that I think there are a lot of teams would really like to be able to have some kind of conclusion? Yes, but are the problems surmountable, I guess, is the bottom line.
Yeah, Coach, I mean, I think I don't know. Do you want to have a moment of silence as an avid Vegas Summer League watcher? Do you want to kind of take a moment and cherish the fact that last year was so great and we probably won't be having it this year? I mean, I don't know how you – have you come to grips with that, Coach?
I love the Vegas Summer League. You know, that kind of is the start of the next season for me.
Right.
Where you start getting – watching the young draft picks in action and seeing the progress of guys who are – you know, trying to get their careers jump started. Somebody like a Markelle Fultz of playing in a summer league, you know, trying to get his career, you know, in gear. You know, there's so many different fascinating storylines, really endless storylines. But I would have great doubt that you'll see it in anything resembling its normal form this year.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Unprecedented times. The NBA plays such a huge role in the Olympic calendar, and that's been postponed. Your point is so valid, Coach, because at some point you're going to be butting up against next season with training camp and whatnot, depending on what time they can get this thing, you know, rolling. We always want to remind everyone that dreams come into reach at Wilmington University. WilMU helps working adults reach their career goals through accredited and affordable degrees and certificates to reach new heights in your field. WilMU works. Find out why at wilmu.edu. Some news into our Sixers Talk podcast right now from Ramona Shelburne of ESPN. Philadelphia 76ers center Joel Embiid has partnered with Sixers owner Josh Harris and David Blitzer to establish a funding campaign for COVID-19 antibody testing for frontline healthcare workers through Penn Medicine, according to a report from Ramona Shelburne. So, I mean, Joel Embiid has already established himself as an integral part of the Philadelphia community and continues to do so by his efforts here and bringing the Sixers organization into it as well. So, honestly, I don't know what else to say, but thank you to Joel for his contributions and his compassion that he's continued to show as he's continued to mature and become, you know, a Sixer that we'll always remember. Coach, impressions of how some of these athletes are handling, you know, these trying times or things that you've seen as far as their contributions to help people get through this?
Yeah, Danny, in a general sense, without, you know, going down name by name, I mean, you already mentioned Joel and Al Horford, certainly add Ben Simmons to the list of the local players.
With the Philly pledge, for sure.
Yeah, I think in general, the professional athletes, they've really showed the bond that they feel with their fans. And I think that's a very real thing. A lot of these guys, you know, they realize I've said over the years, we can't do it without them. And I meant that from you know, deep inside. That's what's professional sports are. It's a bond between teams, players, coaches, and fans. And you tie it all together in a situation like this simply emphasizes it all the more.
Yeah, I think, too, when you look at that, you know, they say, like, moments like this reveal character and just
great point.
Bead, like, the – I mean, everything he's done. I mean, this is, you know, the donations, and then also, you know, when there's news about Karl Anthony Towns and his mom being in a medically induced coma, and him putting aside all the, you know, Joel Embiid putting aside all the petty stuff to just kind of, you know, to say that he, you know, his family's in their thoughts and prayers, and it's just little stuff like that. It just all adds up, and it shows Joel for, like, you know, this stuff to me reveals true character, and it says an awful lot about him. His actions during this thing.
Hey, yeah, let's not forget, man. I mean, this guy dealt with some very traumatic life issues, losing his brother not so long ago, and so much so that in his Players Tribune article that he wrote, he considered walking away from basketball and didn't think that he would be where he was without his brother's influence. So it just goes, you know, without saying that, you know, I brought it up previously, but, you know, I think when you've been through something and experienced life to a certain degree and have
been through moments of having less and being, you know, wanting things. And sometimes when you finally reach that plateau and get things, you don't forget what it was like to be where you were. So when moments like this come up, you see Joel, you know, giving of himself and, you know, being, you know, a man for others and things like that. So I think that his character, like you said, Paul, it just is really shining through, and you see what people are really made of here in, you know, adversity, and their character really shows. So we really appreciate Joel contributing here to the Delaware Valley and the Sixers family as a whole, and supporting the healthcare workers and bringing the organization into it, who, you know, just to be completely, you know, above board and 100%, the Sixers took a PR hit. We talked about it when they initially decided to dock workers' pay and go take them to a 4-day work week, and then retracted that after seeing, you know, the reaction. And Joel was right there after that happened, you know, saying that he wanted to contribute, you know, $500,000 toward helping people stay on their feet and whatnot. So I think all that speaks for itself. But Coach, excited to have you on, excited to hear your voice, and to pick your brain as well. And I was trying to figure out how we would start this road down memory lane, because, you know, we just missed March. Of course, the NCAA tournament will be coming to a head. We got to touch on some of that March Madness stuff with you, as you are the architect and part of one of the most historic moments in NCAA history, as deemed by the NCAA themselves back in their 75th anniversary, when they called you out on the court during that at the Wells Fargo Center as a part of that historic St. Joe's upset at DePaul. But we will get into that. But there was a little thing floating around on social media, Coach, where, of course, you were with the 76ers as an assistant first, and then as a head coach throughout the 80s and the early 90s. And there was something floating around social media, Coach. You probably don't remember it, but it's just really a sign of the times, where Charles Barkley, when he came to the Sixers organization, they had a promotion where they let anyone who weighed 260 pounds or more into the arena free. They had like a scale at the gate where people were walking in. So I just amazed and really loved that, thinking back on those times. Do you remember the fervor with Charles when, you know, he first came up to the organization, and the whole big thing with his weight? And because, you know, when you look back at the tapes, he just looks so dynamic and prolific that you never would think that the weight was such a big issue, because he seemed to carry it so well.
Well, he did carry it well, but no, it was a huge issue. And ironically, Harold Katz, who was the owner of the team,
right,
he made his fortune in that business, Nutrisystem.
Right, okay.
So he was extremely sensitive to Charles's weight issue, and so much to the fact that there were many, many weight clauses in Charles' initial contract. So I think Charles, to his credit, as his playing years advanced, he became more and more aware, you know, of what good conditioning was, how to get there, and how to keep himself in top shape. But in the early years, I think it was an issue.
Of course, Charles credits Moses for, you know, whipping him into shape and really telling him how it was back then. Do you remember that dynamic between those guys at all? I know Moses got traded, you know, right before you came, but did Charles talk about that?
No, I was there 1 year when I came
one
back
year.
As the
okay.
assistant. I was there 1 year with Moses and Doc and Charles.
So the 84-85 year.
Right. And okay. I could simply tell you that there was no doubt the influence that Moses had on Charles. You know, Charles saw him almost as a father figure. And Moses, he was the public persona of Moses was really quite different than who the real guy was. I mean, he was really one of the best. He was a genuine, no-nonsense, come to do his work every day, you know, a person of few words, yes. But when I say, like, when he spoke, like E.F. Hutton, like all heads turned. I could give you a locker room scene. Now's not the time for it. And I mean, this is one of the most dramatic things I ever saw in a locker room, where a player took you know, to just speak to the group. And this was Moses as an assistant coach to Maurice Cheeks. So no surprise to me, like when you hear Charles today speak of the impact and influence that Moses Malone had on him, not just as a professional athlete, but as a person as well.
Coach, now is the time for all the stories, man. Do not hold back. We want them all. We want them all.
Yeah, I'll save that one, Dan, if you don't mind. For a later date.
I got you.
Fair enough. So, Coach, I'm just curious, too, because obviously it was not, you know, not the best of times when Charles was, like, kind of, you know, on the way out. And just whatever you want to share or feel comfortable sharing about just what you remember from that time where he clearly wasn't happy and then ultimately, you know, gets traded to Phoenix and just what that time was kind of like and like just kind of the feeling of the city and what you were going through during that.
Yeah, it was very difficult, Paul, because as you say, Charles was not happy at that point in time for a very simple reason. From his perspective, he didn't think that the franchise was in the position of trying to acquire talent to surround him, and as a result, the future just looked bleak. He couldn't see any way out of being, you know, at best an average team, let alone a contender for a championship. And you know, while all players, you know, love participating on that level, meaning aspiring to be a championship contender, the special players, the stars, I mean, they yearn for that. That you know, literally, that there's something within them that they're made and groomed to try to compete against the best to win the whole thing.
Right, that's what drives
them.
Right.
That was far from the situation here. So Charles, you know, from his perspective, he made it known in no uncertain terms. He didn't want to be here. And I would say hindsight, this is just me, my own personal opinion, you know, we made a mistake in listening to him. And I tell him, I tell Charles that to this day. I remember, and I probably could still dig it out. You know, we got a lot of reaction after the facts, some positive, and I'd say probably more negative than positive if you ran one of those polls that they like to run. But I got one letter in particular that I saved over the years. And it started out, Dear Coach Lynam. And it's the first line, never trade a super, literally, word for word, never trade a super. Second line, never trade a super. So the guy repeated that line like 10 times, never trade a super. And it was a classic of a letter, but end of story, the fellow was right. You can't trade star talent unless you're getting star talent in return, which is rarely the case. Somehow, some way, you have to figure it out and work your way around it. So hindsight, mistake by Jim Lynam and the 76ers and all who had any part of it.
I guess that really, if we go, you know, from back then to now, I guess that kind of nips the Sixers should trade Joel or Ben Simmons conversation in the bud. Like, so you figure it out, I guess, is the answer, right, Coach?
You don't have to nip it in the bud. You can dig the bush out of the ground.
I got you. Enough said on that.
I think that's, and I was going to say, from talking to Coach and from some of the conversations that float around our newsroom about some people wanting, you know, thinking that it's never going to work out, I know Coach is a strong proponent of, no, you get two star players, you figure it out because they're both so talented. And I'm sure, Coach, that, like you just said, I'm sure that situation affected you as much as anything else as far as that opinion.
Without question, Paul, because if nothing else, it dramatizes to you how difficult it is to acquire those special talents. By definition, that's what makes them so special, because they're so rare. And you're not going to win championships without those kind of guys, plain and simple. So that as it relates to current times, I think this is there is a problem here in terms of, like, how do you best blend the talents of these two star players, Embiid And Ben Simmons, yes. Well, guess what? That's what it's about, solving problems. You know, there's an old phrase, problems are, you know, meant to be solved, not rejoiced over. You can talk about them, you know, all day on talk radio. Okay, that's fine. That's great for that segment of the population. If you're in the Sixer side of it, you got to figure this stuff out. And I think these guys are doing a pretty good job of working toward that end. It's not going to be snap your fingers and go out and, you know, you win 70 games and then two straight championships. It's a process, no pun intended. And I think these guys, and when I say these guys, Elton Brand, the front office, all the way up to ownership with Josh Harris and obviously Brett Brown and his staff. And I have confidence that when it's all said and done and you're looking back on this years from now, you will see championships as a result.
Hey, Sixers fans, I know you're missing live sports, so all week long, NBC Sports Philadelphia will be airing classic games and more recent matchups. We'll have you voting on which games you want to see. Make sure to check out our social accounts for alerts on what game is coming up next on NBC Sports Philadelphia. Always stay connected to your teams with the My Teams app and NBCSportsPhiladelphia.com. So, Coach Sam, with that conversation, give us an idea. You know, you already had your own story, you know, basketball career and experiences leading up to joining that Sixers bench. And here you are, you know, right smashed between Moses and Doc and Charles and Mo Cheeks and, you know, all those guys. Is there a story or a moment that sticks out to you where you were like, man, wow, like these guys are the best of the best? Like, where was that in your head?
Obviously, you can add Andrew Toney to that group.
Absolutely. Bobby Jones, yeah.
Sure. Bobby Jones, right, Hall of Famer. I mean, so to come back, I was a fan of that team. I was already working in the NBA. I'd been a head coach. My first job was with the Clippers. Had gotten fired with the Clippers. And then Matty Gukas, who replaced Billy Cunningham. Billy retired, I guess, after winning the championship. Maybe he coached one more year, if memory serves me correct. And Matty, who had been Billy's assistant, became the head coach. So when Matty brought me back as the assistant, you know, I came like with what I like to call a number of hats, one of which was a Philly fan hat. I mean, I was a fan of these guys. And now, you know, I'm going to be a part of the coaching staff to try to win a championship, another championship. And my first story really would be when I came back. I didn't know all these guys personally. I would say probably the best one I knew personally was Doc. But Moses, Charles, Bobby Jones, Cheeks, Andrew Toney, you know, I just knew them casually to say, you know, I do. Moses was like, in my mind, like really just going through the motions. And I like personally was like concerned, you know, maybe after like 3 or 4 days. And I when I would express these feelings is like, is Moses all right? Is he hurt? Does he always kind of start like this? And, you know, it was almost, they're almost to a man dismissive of my thoughts. From Matty right up through Harold Katz, the owner. So this went on for the entire preseason. Moses was beyond pedestrian. And I'm like now really concerned. I mean, this guy was key to our team if we were right. Going to be legit. Well, you ready? We open the season in New York against rookie Patrick Ewing and all the fanfare in New York. Ready? Moses gave Patrick Ewing, you can check it. He gave him 38 and 24 rebounds. It was the first sweat that he broke for probably the last 6 weeks. And he put Patrick Ewing like in the basket about 6 times in that game. So it was a real eye opener for me. And it kind of, again, I had not been around in my brief NBA career, you know, like this kind of talent assembled on one team.
Right.
And I often refer to that story of, you know, what these special guys are about and how talented they are and how few of them there are.
I got a whole visual picture in my head of that whole story because I see the young Jim Lynham, you know, trying to, you know, use his eye test and survey. And then all of a sudden, man, well, you probably said wow on that bench like 15 times watching that game.
Yeah, tell me. film. Yeah. And as I say, that was in kind of in concert with who Moses, I became such a huge Moses fan and really a dear friend. One we coached together with Maurice.
Yeah.
But just that was the way he was. He was a very understated guy. You know, it was never about him. And he was, you know, never about like about trumpeting his own exploits. That was the farthest thing from his mind.
Coach, you like I said, the history speaks for itself with all the things that you've been through. Let's talk about this NCAA tournament. Maybe we'll get back to the pro stuff in a bit, but I just want to say, because I know I have you on the phone right here, and I guess I could have called you anytime I told you this, but in the social media world, sometimes you just say how you feel sometimes, and then people latch onto it or they don't. But, you know, the coronavirus stuff had broken out, and we were all just, you know, looking for something to latch onto. And I was surfing through Twitter, and a retrospective, a look back in history of the NCAA tournament came on, and it was St. Joe's with the young Jim Lynham, you know, looking all dapper and sharp and into the game as he always is. And it was your team upsetting DePaul, which I had seen so many times and I'd known for so long. But in this moment, it wasn't the basketball that caught my attention, because I had seen the plays and the, you know, the last second shot and the exuberance afterward. But it was after the game went to triple zeros and you're looking around to celebrate, and then a woman streaks across the court and just jumps in your arms, man. It was just the best hug I had. And the fact that I couldn't hug my own parents, and I realized that it was your daughter, D. Lynham, running in and giving you a hug, and knowing you and knowing D, it just really, like, I almost got a little emotional just watching it, because I couldn't, you know, social distancing makes it so I'm not, you know, near my parents, and they help out a lot with my family, my kids a lot. So not being able to be there and them and seeing that hug between you and D, and thinking back to, you know, not being able to see March Madness and, you know, sports being gone and seeing that, it really brought a lot of joy to me. Can you take us back to that moment specifically from that game when the clock strikes zero, you guys have won and upset the number one seed, and D jumps in your arms? Do you remember that?
Obviously, yeah, I do, Danny. And I don't have memories for like a lot of things like that. You know, specifics, but you know, that was so unique in so many ways. And I have to say that you know, it's mixed emotion, like flying at you like literally second by second.
Mm-hmm.
So my personal feelings, you know, when the clock hit zero, the first thing I noticed, Mark Aguirre has the ball under the basket.
Mm.
And he has it cradled, like, and in no hurry, like when the ball goes through the net, he grabs it and he kind of looks and he takes a step toward the end line and turns back toward the court. And I'm like, why isn't he rushing? Is like the thought that is flying in my head.
Right.
And then the next thought is, oh, they're going to put time back on the clock. And then I realize they say, no, they don't have any timeouts.
Because you never think it's over. You never quite think this.
Exactly. It took me probably a second to two to process that the game was actually over. Mm-hmm. So then it's euphoria that hit me. And now I turn and I want to go to, you know, to the other
shake
bench
hands.
For Coach Meyer, who I knew.
Right.
And as I'm like euphoric in this moment, then all of a sudden I see him and his face. And it was like, oh no. And right at that point, I had it like, and it was just a second, 2 seconds, whatever, like of empathy. Like, what would it be like? I mean, because he thought he had a national championship team.
Right.
And he certainly was, you know, incredibly close to it. And so when I ran up to him and shook his hand, I don't even remember what I said or what he said, but it was a brief 2 second encounter. And again, then the euphoria is sweeping me up again. At that moment, you know, players and my daughter come, who I didn't even know was on the bench. She mm-hmm. pulled a typical D lineman to weasel her way. Got a press pass and a seat on the bench. I didn't even know she. You know, when you're involved in the game, you know nothing of what goes on around. Yeah, right. You know, the periphery, I call it. So here she was sitting, you know what, less than 10 yards away from me the entire game. I had no idea. So that just dramatized, you know, the whole surreal aspect of it. And I would say kind of after the fact, I don't think I really appreciated how much something like that, like whether it's a Phillies winning a World Series, how much something like that in sports, you know, which when you do it for a living, you try to, you know, try, you do, you divorce yourself a little bit from the emotion of it. Well, fans, sure. Not only do they not divorce themselves, they kind of encompass it. You know, right. they seize upon it. And if I could tell you what over, like, let's say the period of time of years, that game meant to a lot of the St. Joe community, I could never have dreamed. And, you know, I'm sure many people, you know, in the Delaware Valley area, like Villanova winning two NCAA championships in the span of 3 years. I mean, are you serious? And what that, you know, just does for the psyche of a whole community. It's very, very hard to exaggerate.
Yeah, I'm curious, Coach Shue, because you're going into that thing. That the ball team was stacked. I mean, they were really, really, obviously they're one seed for a reason, right? So, I mean, they were, what is your message going into that game when you know what you're up against? What is the message to the team? And then kind of how do you keep everyone kind of confident and feeling like they can pull that upset off?
Well, it's a good question, Paul. I'll tell you exactly what my message was. Now, first of all, you have to understand I had a good team.
Sure.
You know, my team had already won, 24, 25 games, which back then was a lot. So these guys, Brian Warwick is going to go on and play in the NBA, you know, for the next 5 or 6 years. I had a guy I call the soul of that team was John Smith, who's from South Philly. And I get news for you, John Smith can go out and play against anybody. He might not outscore them, out-rebound them, but he's going to hold his own against anybody he plays against. Just a tough street guy, 6'5", from South Philly, who knew how to play basketball. I had two of the Parade All-American freshmen on that team, Lonnie McFarland and Tony Costner. Ironically, we beat Villanova out for both of them. So we had a real good team. But to your specific question, how do we prepare? I'll tell you exactly how, in a nutshell. The night before the game, in a hotel in Dayton, I brought the team into a room. And I said, we want to give you the scout report. I hadn't given us a thing yet in the way of preparation. It's the night before the game. I told them at the practice, when we got to Dayton, we practiced. And I told them, we're going to talk about a couple just general things that we're going to do. I said, when we get to the hotel, we'll talk about Dayton. So when I got to the hotel, I had the camera set up, and I put on an 8mm film. And what was it? It was a film of Dayton playing against LaSalle at the Palestra, and it was a doubleheader game. We played the first game. So my guys saw the second game, and I knew that. And on LaSalle, the backcourt was for LaSalle was Kevin Lynam, my brother, and his best friend, who was a golf scholarship to LaSalle by the name of Greg Webster. That was the starting backcourt for LaSalle. LaSalle loses to DePaul by 3 points. I turned the tape on. I didn't say a word during the tape. We watched about 7 or 8 minutes, the wire of the game, the end of the game. And when the game ended, I hit the light switch. There's nobody talking. I said, you know what? I think if that team, bleep, bleep, backcourt, can play DePaul a three-pointer, I think we have a shot.
I love it.
I'm sure your brother Kevin waited a few years to hear that story, but
well, Greg Webster is a good friend. Like we go to he, Kevin, myself, a few of their buddies, and all my brothers. We go to Florida every year for a week to play golf.
Coach, you know it's funny. You know we had got your thoughts. You know it's not funny, but you know what I'm trying to say. But we got your thoughts on the NCAA NBA situation and. this unprecedented situation they're going through. NCAA was a little late to the party to cancel March Madness, you know, trying to hold out hope that something could happen. But obviously we're way past that point now. Was that more of a surreal moment considering, you know, having, you know, played college ball and coached it and been a part of such a historic moment in NCAA history? Did that strike you more as like, wow, or vice versa? Where did you fall in
it? I have to say, yes and no would be my answer, Danny. When Adam Silver was the first one, and I'm a huge Adam Silver guy. I don't know him that well. I knew David Stern better, but Adam Silver was David Stern's sidekick for many, many years.
Right.
And when I tell you David Stern is as good as it gets, like, don't bother, you know, that like of the guys in your profession, you know, rank them one through whatever. Well, when it comes to ranking the commissioners of all time, just start with David Stern on the top line and go from there. That's how good he was. So Adam Silver learning from the best, in my opinion. No, not a coincidence that he was the first one to make what was a really, in my opinion, a courageous decision. And I choose that word carefully, to shut down the NBA. And of course, by the next day, everybody else, you know, fell in the line. But for the first guy to have the courage to do that and to use intellect to realize the enormity of the problem that we are about to face.
Right.
So therefore, your question about the NCAA, no, after the first domino fell, nothing surprised me. I said, I'll be honest with you, when this thing started all the way back, I'm a bit of a worrywart. When I would be listening to this stuff when they were talking about China, and when they said the only thing to combat it, and the word quarantine, and I was like, in the beginning, I mean, I thought I knew what quarantine meant. But when you take quarantine to its ultimate conclusion, everything stops,
right.
Period.
And Coach, you're someone who has been to China for Basketball Without Borders and
on many occasions.
Right. So having an intricate, you know, knowledge of what basketball is like over there, they were trying to get games started back up, you know, after the coronavirus flattened out. Did that surprise you that they were so eager to get hoops back over there?
Well, I didn't know that specifically, to be frank, but no, nothing would surprise me in that, like, once you can see daylight, I would think that the powers that be, you know, would want to do everything that they possibly could to start, you know, returning to a quote normal.
Yeah, business as usual, Bert.
Yeah, and obviously it's not going to happen overnight, either there or here. But you'd certainly like to take those steps.
Coach, I want to go back to your NBA career a little bit, and you were also you talked about being on Mo's staff in Portland, and I'm just curious because that team, those teams had some interesting characters, obviously.
And just affectionately known, Paul, as the Jailblazers.
Yes, I wasn't going to say
get
it.
Get to the point.
You said it, Coach. No, but I love it. But just what was that like as far as, you know, a guy like Rasheed Wallace, who I know Danny and I are big fans of him as a basketball player and obviously being from Philly and just, you know, we're big fans of his game and you know, his career. And also a guy like, you know, Sabonis, who was such a rare player and had such a rare skill set that now you see more big men who are skilled. So just what are some of maybe your more fond memories of being in Portland and being around some of those guys?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite groups, to be honest, Paul. You know, you just mentioned Rasheed and Sabonis, Zach Randolph was on that team, Bonzi Wells, Damon Stoudemire. I mean, we had a really, really good team. We lost that was, you know, in the Western Conference back then, you know, you had a lot of really standout teams that the Lakers with Shaq and Kobe, you know, they were the best for sure, but they weren't light years ahead. We lost a 7-game series in the playoffs to Dirk Nowitzki and Steve Nash. So, I mean, you're talking two of the all-time greats.
Yeah.
You know, beat us in a 7th game. I think we lose 3. in Dallas in game seven. So that team was, probably the one of the more unique teams in terms of the personality makeup of the group. The group was in the building, like to practice. It was like one of the funnest groups I've ever been around. However, if you were a front office guy or a general manager, it was a nightmare because you had no idea what one of these guys, you know, might do off the court, you know, at any given time. But, basically they were good guys. I won't say that they didn't have some problems, and at times they should have used better judgment, you know, away from the court for sure. But let me just add in terms of Rashid, I knew Rashid when he was a young guy coming up. We met at a camp where I was speaking, and he was a camper. I think it was his junior year, and I knew who he was, and we had never met. And I kind of picked him out of the group, introduced myself, and you know, he helped me with the lecture. And from that day on, I always felt that, you know, we had a relationship and, you know, the utmost of respect, you know, one for the other.
Do you have any good Rasheed Wallace stories? I'm just curious.
Well, he was a free spirit. I mean, I think everybody knew that.
Sure.
You know, like his antics with the referee. I mean, you hear announcers today. You know, you make a profound, you know, effect when they copy you over the years.
Right.
You know, when he would go off and, you know, get a technical over whatever. And then when the guy would shoot the free throw and miss it, you know, she would yell out, "Ball don't lie." Well, you know, that's like a classic today. You know, you hear an announcer say, "Well, ball don't lie," I guess.
Right.
You know,
right,
on what was a questionable call.
Right.
But he was a huge Kansas City fan, Kansas City Chief fan. And every Monday morning after a Chiefs game, he literally would walk onto the court. He'd have a ball under his arm. He'd have a Kansas City, real Kansas City Chiefs helmet on his head. And the first 15 minutes of practice, he would shoot with the Kansas City helmet on his head.
Well, I guess he's on cloud nine now after they won the Super Bowl finally.
Yeah. And how about this? For those who wouldn't know, Rasheed Wallace is a high school coach in North Carolina.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember he was an assistant with the Knicks, and he looked so much more like a coach than I would expect. Like, working with big men is one thing, but you know, spreading your voice across, you know, any and every position is different. But I just see the players, and they're locked into like their attention to detail of what he's doing, and he just has them captivated, you know. So I'm not surprised by that, but it's definitely cool.
He's Danny, obviously an incredibly bright guy, like a really, really high level NBA player. But I will tell you, if you took the time to see Rashid's numbers, how he performed against the top players, I'm talking like the Kevin Garnetts, the Elton Brands,
Tim Duncan,
the Dirk Nowitzkis. You get Sheed's numbers, because I did it, because at times I felt the need to defend him because I knew they were trying to trade him. And, I made it almost a mission. And not only did he, like, fare well, he actually bested most of those guys in head-to-head competition. That's not an exaggeration. It's a statement of fact.
Wow. What about Sabonis, Coach? Was it, like, what did you know about him coming in, and then what did you kind of learn about him as you coached him?
Well, I obviously knew his reputation, and I have to be honest and say I was somewhat skeptical. You know, there were those who felt that before he ever came to the NBA, when he was playing in Europe, that he was the best big man on the planet. And I, you know, to me, that was like hyperbole. That these guys, they love to say stuff like that. He's playing against European competition and not the NBA. But when I got into, I say, like, you really don't know a guy till you get in a gym with him. I could see how that would have been possible. I'm not saying it was true. I wasn't there to observe it. And so I can't have a firsthand opinion. But despite being, you know, well on the downstroke of his career, I'd say he was certainly in his 30s, maybe 32, when I got to Portland. But oh my goodness, I will say one of the most unique players that I ever saw. I mean, he was a huge, huge guy. you know, every bit of 7'2", you know, with girth. But man, what, like, soft touch, shoot it as far as you want it to shoot it. One of the first days that in practice, we're just doing a little loosen up drill, like three guys full court. You know, you throw a pass to somebody, go behind them, and you're running the court, maybe three passes. He threw a behind the back bounce pass. Not by design, you kind of instinctively. He threw like a 60-foot behind the back bounce pass to a cutter going to the goal. Yeah, this guy 7'2", you know, kind of lumbering up the sideline. And you're like, oh my God. But he was an incredible player. I can only imagine how good he was, you know, in his prime.
Coach, I always wanted to get a little insight into your relationship with Mo Cheeks, because that really speaks to why you were in Portland, because he wanted to bring you on as part of the staff. Obviously into the Hall of Fame now. My dad always talked about how much he loved chocolate chip cookies. But you think about Moses, Doc, Charles, Mo Cheeks, Bobby Jones, Andrew Toney, like, you know, one of the all-time rosters and lineups in NBA history. And then you have such a relationship with Mo Cheeks that he not only, you know, wants you as a part of his staff, I'm sure you guys have a personal relationship as well. Was that like a point guard to point guard type thing? Or how did that really come to be such a intricate part of your basketball story?
Yeah, I guess it does, Danny. Not by design on my part. You know, I was always a big Cheeks fan. But, you know, when you start coaching, whatever that affinity you had for a guy in that light, meaning fan-like, that dissolves. And now it's a different situation. You know, he's your player. But that I always had the utmost confidence in Maurice, absolutely respected to the highest degree, you know, what he brought to the game. You know, sometimes I don't know if everybody, you know, relates to, sometimes you put a thought out there that from your perspective, it nails it. That's it. But when I say, like, number one for Cheeks, the game is never too big for him. That's a huge compliment that I would pay a player, because for a lot of good players, the game can get too big. Charles Barkley used to tell me, he says, you know, coach, you know, you got to be careful who you set that last shot up for. You know, obviously he said it one night when I didn't set it up for him. But the fact of the matter is that Charles is right. Not everybody, you know, relishes having to take or looks forward to taking the shot that's going to decide the game one way or the other. Well, in that light, Cheeks was like as good as there was. The game never too big for him. And the second thing I would say is rarely did Maurice Cheeks get outplayed. The guy who he was playing against might be a 25-point scorer. And Cheeks is more, you know, like a low double-figure scorer. But despite that, he never gets outplayed. He always finds a way where the ultimate contribution that he makes versus the contribution that guy makes is at least about equal. Way more often than not, Cheeks bests the guy he's playing against. So I think when I coached him, Cheeks knew that's how I saw him. Mm-hmm. That was the type of respect I had for him as a player and as a person. And I think over a period of time, it started to become mutual. He saw like qualities in me as a coach that he admired. And somehow that's how, you know, a bond gets established. And I will have to mention this. Whatever that bond we established as player and coach was strong enough to withstand the following. They want to trade Cheeks.
Right.
At the time, I have to be honest, in the beginning, I was against it. I came to a point where I said, all right, and the reasons they felt they had to move on, fine. I was in concert. If this is what we're going to do, we're going to do it. So I said, just let's make sure the circumstances, you know, or we do it properly. So the setting is we're at practice at St. Joe. We finished practice, and they told me they're pretty sure it's going to go down today. So the powers that be, Harold Katz, John Nash, are in one of the St. Joe offices on the phone, and they're literally thinking they're about to consummate the trade. And, you know, it, when you say consummate means two teams are on a line with the league office. So I'm assuming that's what's taking place. And I'm still in my gear. Practice is just finished. And somebody comes out and said, like, don't let Maurice, you know, go. This thing might go down. So I have somebody, a trusted good friend, you know, say, keep your eye on Cheeks. Like, you know, make sure he don't literally go out the door. So I'm doing my thing with the media after practice. And not only this is probably over a period of 15 minutes. And they come to me. It's done. I go to the person. I say, where's Mo? And he goes, I'm not sure. And I knew right then it was like the sirens went off when he went. He looked right and left. I'm not sure was the word for word quote. And I just went, the feeling that came over me. So here's what happens. Over the next 4 hours, I am literally running around the city of Philadelphia looking for Maurice Cheeks. I end up down on his street, parked on his street in South Philly. I wait there in my car for about a half hour. This is pre-cell phone. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, when I get home, I see on the news, who pulls up right after me in a news truck, but Michael Barkan.
Shut up.
In a news truck. And he's now sitting outside of Cheeks' house. About 10. This is right after I left.
Dang.
10 minutes. The truck is there in front of the house. I find out afterwards. And who drives up the street but Maurice Cheeks? Barkan jumps out with a mic. Cheeks has not heard of the trade. Pre-cell phone. Has not heard of the trade. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Trade probably went down around noon. And, of course, he was, like, devastated. I was, like, emotionally in a wreck for who knows how long. And what was obviously a very, very tough time, end of the story, Cheeks took me with him to Portland for his first coaching job.
Cool. That is an awful way to find out. I think the thing, though, that he has been lauded for specifically so much is how classy he has been over the years. In 2003, there was a moment while he was the head coach of Portland that really brought that whole thing to a head, where there was a young girl singing the national anthem. And she forgot the words, and he comes out and helps her finish singing the anthem.
Brought the whole building into it.
Yes.
As a result. Yes.
Yes. Do you remember that night? What do you remember about it?
You ready?
Yeah.
I have a word, one of my favorites, Danny. When you guys were talking earlier about Joel Embiid, the word is empathy, where one is able to feel for the next person, to identify to some degree, like what they are experiencing, and to have some of that feelings of like wanting to help and knowing, you know, I can't possibly do anything near enough. And that night when Cheeks came to that little girl's rescue, 20,000 people in that building in the Rose Garden experienced that. And they all as one reached out to help that little girl. And Cheeks, he was really the prime motivator of engendering that feeling.
Yeah, man. Historic, I don't want to exaggerate it and say it's one of the greatest moments in sports, but definitely something. If you've seen it, you remember it. You didn't have to be there, but if you saw
it. Oh, I got news for you. It was one of my more memorable times in sports.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm glad to hear you say that, Coach, because it definitely struck a chord with so many people who saw it and haven't been in an arena. Just very curious to see how it affected you.
No, it was that really typified. And yeah, as I like to say now to Cheeks after the fact, and you can't sing.
I want to take this opportunity while we have Coach, because I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't bring up stuff about Dr. J, because we talked about Mo, we've talked about Moses, you know, but Coach, just your experiences with him. I mean, you come on after he wins a championship. But just again, just like kind of like just your impression. You said you kind of knew him of all the guys. That was the guy you kind of knew. So like, what was it before you got into the coaching spot and then after? And what was your experience like with him?
Well, you know, the younger folks, Paul, can't appreciate the impact that Doc had on the sport, both on the court and away from it. as a player on the court, he really was the first. And, you know, sometimes people are reluctant to kind of christen someone with that. Oh, I remember so-and-so. Well, I'll give my opinion. You know, like everybody else, I'm welcome to it. But I really think that for playing above the rim, I mean, playing in the stratosphere, he brought the game up there. I think he was the first one because he did it in such a, it was a combination of spectacular and graceful. It was at times, you know, when they have, I've actually seen over the years that put some of his dunks to ballet music, you know, as he would be gliding through midair. And I think that was the Dr. J that that I kind of saw before I went back to the Sixers. And I certainly knew him by, you know, reputation as just like a beyond a stand-up guy. And my years with him with the Sixers, I guess it was probably two more years, maybe three. But I couldn't say enough to the way he handled being who he was. It was like really, it was like a course. If you wanted to say like, now there's going to be different facets, different elements to being a top level professional athlete. Well, I got news for you. He wrote the book for me. That's how, what a class act he was. He, one night, the first year I was there, it was a preseason game. And I want to say it was in Birmingham, Alabama, which is where Charles was from. I won't swear, but it was somewhere down south. And there was a situation, and Doc, after the game, I mean, when I say there was a mob scene after every game, particularly preseason games, because these are people in areas that would never see a Dr. J, let alone a professional athlete. So somehow after the game, well after, there's this like big crowd of people. And myself and Al Domenico, rest his soul, the trainer of the team, we're walking with Doc. I actually, somebody sent me off the bus. Matty Gukas, I think, asked me, like, go get Doc, because he knows Doc's going to be there, you know, catering to the fans literally for an hour. So we want to leave. So I'm in like the locker room area and trying to get Doc on the move. So it's Al Domenico, myself, Doc, and there's state police, as is the case, you know, when you get down south, you see it on the TV at the football games. And as we're walking down this corridor with people all over the place, a fan kind of like barges out with a pad and a pen, and obviously somewhat inebriated. And the first cop like takes exception. So you can picture the scene. So here's Doc, and Doc is, he's trying to like take care of the fan. Sure, sure, I'll sign. And this cop, you know, literally with a stick. To see Doc defuse that, he like takes care of the fan. Fine, my man, he says, but we got to go. And boom, the fan's ecstatic because he got the autograph. Turns to the cop, and I could see in the cop's eye, he's irate. And he went, he puts his arm out to the cop, and he kind of gives him a side embrace. He says, thanks, my man. I appreciated that. And I went like, are you kidding me? It was like watching somebody walk on water. I mean, right. He diffused what could have been, you know, a split skull and a near riot in a matter of seconds. That's how good he was.
Oh, man, I felt a little chills from that story. That's cool, man.
Yeah, as you know, Danny, Paul, you and I don't go as far back, but I don't make this stuff up. That's how good. You asked me who Dr. J was. That those two things personify Doc. He was the first player to do what he did up there, way up there, and just get your finger and point high. That's where he played, and nobody ever did it before him like he did. And then add to it that little vignette that I tied. That encompasses Dr. J to me.
Yeah, Coach. We didn't even get into the Will Chamberlain story, so. Hey,
that'll be for another time.
Yeah, we'll say that for another time, man. We'll have to say that for another time. Paul, thank you for tying that in the bow, man. Woo. Because wouldn't have been the same pod without that story. But hey, we appreciate you as always, Coach, for everything that you do for us, and always being available and ready with any questions or thoughts or being able to share stories or what have you. So just appreciate you and your presence, Coach, and glad you're doing well.
No, Danny, let me say that I appreciate having the chance to go on with you guys. You know I enjoy it. And for me, it's kind of a good feeling, and I mean that, an inner good feeling that I get, you know, in sharing stuff with guys like you, because it reminds me of how many of those folks out there, from every name that we just mentioned, what they gave to me. And I realize how fortunate that I've been to be in that situation over the years.
Sure, Coach.
Beautiful,
we could listen. I could listen to you for hours, Coach, and I mean that legitimately. I really could.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it, guys.
Coach. Thanks, hey, Coach. We do want to remind everyone, Sixers fans, we know you're missing live sports. You can always take a break with your teams in the My Teams app. You'll be able to check out Paul's articles, all the other articles on the website from me, as well as Noah Levick and so many other of our colleagues. Go ahead and check out the My Teams app and share a story with a friend. Paul, is there anything specific that you wanted to highlight on the website that you're working on?
So I know that we just, Noah just worked up something on the Embiid, his most recent donation and his recent efforts. So there's more on that. If you're interested in that, some good quotes from Embiid himself on that topic. We're going to start getting really heavy into the NBA draft stuff. You know, we don't know when the draft's going to happen, and we don't really, you know, there's still a lot of questions left unanswered, but we're going to start evaluating some guys. We got a lot of people that really know a lot about college basketball and a lot of really good people on our staff who are going to help us out, like Amy Fadul, Sean Kane, Brian Brennan, Casey Feeney. So, you know, and then obviously Noah and myself will be pitching in there. So be on the lookout for a lot of draft content coming your way shortly.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Continue to subscribe and send those 5-star ratings our way. For our co-host, Jim Lynham, for the level-headed one, Paul Hudrick, for our esteemed producer, Ben Berry, I'm Danny Pommels. Thanks for listening to Sixers Talk, brought to you by Wilmington University. Wilmu works. We will see you next time.